or any medical item it would buy from foreign firms. World leaders have time and again called on Washington to exempt humanitarian supplies from the list of its anti-Iran sanctions, but to no avail.
U.S. sanctions are inhumane and illegal. Washington says it is targeting the Iranian government, but they are targeting the Iranian people.
Iranian human rights officials say U.S.'s rights violations against Iranians has been kept under the rug for decades. The bitter reality, they say, has come to light during the coronavirus pandemic, when American officials continued the ban against Iran.
Medical supplies and food cannot be banned. It's a violation of all international laws to ban such items. But unfortunately, we see that the U.S. and EU have continued their illegal sanctions against Iranians to achieve their political interests.
When it comes to the COVID vaccine, the World Health Organization has launched the so-called COVAX initiative to ensure fair distribution of vaccines across the world. Officials here believe a similar initiative needs to be put in place by the WHO for other pharmaceuticals to ensure equal access to life-saving medicine across the world, far from any political agenda.
Hadi is one of the countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions against Iran. Rights activists say the ultimate solution lies in the hands of world leaders to avoid holding innocent lives hostage for their political gains. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hospitals across the occupied West Bank are full, and intensive care units operating at over 100% capacity as the number of the coronavirus patients in some cities are growing significantly. A new field hospital is set to open near occupied city of Ramallah, and some parks will be converted to field hospitals as well in an attempt to cope with the new wave of infections.
The number of patients exceeds the capacity of hospitals. In particular, the capacity of the oxygen generators as well as the beds. We've opened new wards as the situation has deteriorated. But the wards open and the numbers continue to rise, we're at 100% capacity in general, even at 110% capacity in some hospitals. That's why there's an urgent need for field hospitals, and we have information that the work will start in 2 days.
Palestinian Health Minister May Al-Kayla said earlier that the West Bank is facing a third wave of the pandemic. The Palestinian government has imposed the new restrictions, including the closure of schools and universities. But it seems that measures have failed to quell rising infections among the Palestinians.
The situation is very difficult. It can be described as an unprecedented coronavirus cases spike. We were hoping not to open field hospitals, but to witness an end to this virus. After recommendations from Health Directorate and the Ministry of Health, there is an urgent need for a serious position from all the Palestinians. After 1 year, they should completely abide by the measures.
People of the West Bank demand the Palestinian Authority to import vaccines. However, the PA has managed to acquire only a few thousand doses of vaccines, not even enough for frontline health workers. As observers say, the gap between Israel and the Palestinians has illustrated the global inequity between rich and poor nations in terms of access to vaccines. UN officials and human rights groups have expressed concerns over the disparity, saying Israel is an occupying power that is responsible for the well-being of the Palestinians.
1 year on, the COVID-19 still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals filled up amid shortage of medical equipment. This has led the Palestinian Authority to adopt new measures, including strict lockdown, to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair. After hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress.
Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity and safety of the Rohingya refugees as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a rarely seen demonstration of unity, the French solidarity movement with Palestine showed its support for Olivia Zemmour, one of the pillars of the BDS movement. Olivia will be judged next week for her participation in BDS actions. The official accusation, anti-Semitism, an insult towards a foreign state. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Against Israel.
There is no legal base to condemn me, and therefore I hope that the judges will remain independent from the political powers. By the way, the French state accepts boycott actions against China, Corsica, or against Russia and Iran. They accept that Brigitte Bardot boycotts Canadian products because of mistreating seals. But if we boycott Israel, they say it's discrimination.
The French government is acting against an important resolution of the European Court of Human Rights. This court decided in June last year that BDS is a legal political movement and obliged the French state to pay 100,000 euros to falsely condemned BDS activists. However, the French Justice Minister, Éric Dupond-Moretti, gave instructions to prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products. Since 2005, Olivia Zemmour is one of the main organizers of the BDS campaign in France, with remarkable actions in supermarkets. These kind of actions were considered worldwide as keystones and have been copied in many other countries. Other type of actions were held in official institutions like the French Football Federation to protest against the silence of Europe when Israel jailed, injured or killed footballers in Gaza. A third type of actions were protests when delegations to Palestine were withheld by Air France under direct Israeli pressure.
BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions campaign, it's very important for us as a Jewish organization to support Palestinian rights, to tell Israel that it must respect international law and that it can't get away with murder. It can't get away with just anything. And this fallacious accusation of anti-Semitism just doesn't hold water.
Today, Israel considers the BDS campaign as a real danger for its propaganda system. Therefore, it uses all kinds of pressure on Western states to criminalize it. But the Palestinian Solidarity Movement stands still and alert. As observers say, if the French government wanted to respect the recommendation of the European Court of Human Rights, it would simply cancel this trial against the deported BDS activist. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Social Rights Commissioner Nicola Schmidt has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatise essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding, it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection. The spread of virus mutations and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Social Rights Commissioner Nicola Schmidt has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatise essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding, it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection. The spread of virus mutations and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Protesters gathered in Islamabad to agitate against Western-funded NGOs. At the heart of their resentment are recently held rallies by the Western-funded NGOs on the eve of International Women's Day few days ago. These protesters believe that the NGOs are systematically engaged in playing with established social norms and Islamic values by promoting Western brand of human rights in Pakistan. Many of the activists of the NGOs allegedly raise slogans of protecting lesbian and gay rights, something which is deeply offensive in a conservative Islamic society.
They're foreign-funded NGOs. They want to spread vulgarity in Pakistan. They want to spread the message of homosexuality in Pakistan. And in a country like Islamic Republic of Pakistan, we'll never ever allow this sort of vulgarity, inshallah. They want to tarnish the image of Pakistan, the ideology on the basis of which Pakistan got created, on the basis of which Pakistan came into being. They wanted to destroy that ideology, basically.
Islam has given full rights to women. No other religion has given the kind of rights which Islam has given to the women. But these NGOs are spreading obscenity and insulting Islam. The government must ban such NGOs.
There is a growing outrage in Pakistan since the NGOs started highlighting the sufferings of women from Western perspective. The number of incidents of violence against Pakistani women are far less than the Western countries funding NGOs in Pakistan to promote women's rights.
The bigger part of the problem with the Western-funded NGOs is that they are focusing more on issues which might have hurt the values of a tiny liberal class in Pakistan. They hardly realize that Pakistan's social fabric is deeply conservative, and they feel offended over their attempts to secularize a society built on the norms of Islam. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
COVID-19 inflicted substantial economic damage on some Latin American countries. Aside from the initial health shock, economies were hit by declining commodity prices, a huge drop in export volumes, loss of remittances and tourism revenue, and unprecedented capital outflows early in the crisis. As a result, many large and small firms ran out of cash and had to close down. China's quick economic recovery has since boosted commodity prices, and remittances have picked up too. But the picture for capital flows remains mixed, with Latin America managed to avoid a lasting panic, private outflows often offset the inflows from issuing government bonds abroad. We now present you an article written jointly by Mauricio Cardenas, Eduardo Levi-Yeyati, and Andres Velasco. The piece is titled Latin America's Pandemic of Mounting Troubles. The article has been published on livemint.com website. Many regions performed badly when confronted with COVID-19, but Latin America fared worse than most in terms of both lives and livelihoods lost. As of November 2020, 9 of the 20 countries with the highest number of COVID-19 deaths per capita were in Latin America. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, expected the region's output to drop by 8.1% in 2020, with only the Eurozone suffering a bigger regional decline. As a result, almost 15 million more Latin Americans will live in extreme poverty. The first explanation for the region's underperformance that comes to mind is poor leadership. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro initially claimed that the pandemic was a media trick. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador denied for weeks that the coronavirus was a threat and continued to hug and handshake with supporters, only to reverse course suddenly and impose a strict lockdown. But even in those countries that acted early, containment measures were ineffective at reducing the number of COVID-19 cases. In Argentina and Peru, which locked down hard, and Chile and Colombia, which followed a more flexible approach, ultimately suffered similar dismal health outcomes. That was partly because some Latin American countries' starting point was far from ideal. Too many people had pre-existing health problems, and the prevalence of multi-generational living arrangements facilitated contagion and infection of those most at risk. Large informal labor markets made lockdowns hard to enforce. A high incidence of face-to-face jobs, including in retail sales, and a scarcity of remote work opportunities owing to poor connectivity and low digital literacy didn't help either. Government ineffectiveness left healthcare systems unprepared, despite early lockdowns that postponed the contagion peak. None of this excuses the fact that many policymakers did too little too late, but it helps to explain why different strategies yielded similar outcomes. The performance of Uruguay, the region's sole success story, arguably shows what a combination of universal healthcare access, greater labor market formality and social protection, relatively strong state capacity and sensible leadership might have delivered for all of Latin America. COVID-19 inflicted substantial economic damage on Latin America, not least because the region suffered 5 synchronous blows. Aside from the initial health shock, economies were hit by declining commodity prices, a huge drop in export volumes, loss of remittances and loss of tourism revenue, and unprecedented capital outflows early on in the crisis. As a result, many large and small firms ran out of cash and had to close down. China's quick economic recovery has since boosted commodity prices and remittances have picked up too. But the picture for capital flows remains mixed. While Latin America managed to avoid a lasting panic, private outflows often offset the inflows from issuing government bonds abroad. Mexico likely ran a current account surplus in 2020, with South America as a whole being close to balance, suggesting that external financing conditions remain tight. This current account performance also indicates that Latin American governments' counter-cyclical fiscal spending was insufficient to offset the drop in private consumption and private investment. whereas governments in advanced economies deployed a broad array of discretionary fiscal measures amounting to 20% of the gross domestic product GDP, the International Monetary Fund puts the corresponding figure in Latin America at 7%. Only four countries in Latin America, Peru, Brazil, Chile, and Bolivia, had packages totaling 10% or more of their GDP. And this figure includes loans and deferred taxes, in addition to extra public expenditure. Some countries, like Mexico, could have spent more but chose not to, while many others lacked fiscal space or were unable to tap capital markets at reasonable interest rates. Latin America's jobs outlook is also discouraging, despite government furlough schemes that are still funding temporary employment suspensions and mitigating the destruction of salary jobs. Employment has declined by 10 to 25% in Lima, Peru. An extreme case, it fell by more than 50% in June of 2020. As of September, the region's employed population had fallen by more than 25.3 million. Since the start of the pandemic, with women and young people disproportionately affected. Those under the age of 24 have suffered the greatest employment losses, ranging from 5% in Mexico to 44.4% in Chile. Moreover, there will be no back to normal after the coronavirus pandemic. Digitalization will likely depress demand for contact-intensive occupations and push firms to automate and streamline their operations at the expense of jobs. Overall, Latin America's underperformance during the pandemic has revealed pervasive shortcomings in state capacity that extend far beyond the region's obviously weak healthcare systems. A few governments lack the necessary information to identify poor households and provide them with financial help. Others had it, but could only write a check instead of transferring funds electronically. The resulting queues and clusters of people outside bank branches may have contributed to the coronavirus spread. And long after schools reopened in Europe and Asia, classes in much of Latin America remained suspended, owing to persistent logistical difficulties. This is adding permanent know-how costs to the ongoing job destruction, particularly for low-income households. Another structural weakness is the region's dual labor market, which disproportionately exposes low-income workers to income shocks. About half of the region's workers are informal wage earners or self-employed without a college degree. In Nicaragua, Paraguay, and Peru, more than two-thirds of workers are informal. Unable to benefit from wage subsidies and furlough schemes, many of them depended during lockdowns on government cash transfers that compensated for the only part of their lost income. In contrast, many Latin American countries offer generous labor protections to high-wage salaried workers. Colombia, for example, introduced a subsidy equivalent to 40% of the minimum wage for all formal jobs in firms that had experienced revenue losses. Argentina's government went even further, doubling severance payments and eventually banning layoffs outright. But such protection goes to a minority of formal employees, while most informal and independent workers remain unprotected. The consequences of this were painfully obvious in the first half of 2020, with incomes of people at the top dropping by much less than those of people at the bottom. The COVID-19 crisis is an opportunity for Latin American governments to strengthen the state, reform dysfunctional labor markets, and accelerate the search for a new social contract. That means rethinking social protection, including by moving towards universal healthcare coverage, reducing barriers to formal employment, and enhancing income stability for independent workers. But the necessary changes are politically difficult to achieve. Restructuring government agencies and labor market rules quickly ruffles the feathers of powerful vested interests, which is why governments have until now remained on the path of least resistance. With several Latin American countries scheduled to hold elections in 2021, the crucial question is whether the regional political climate will improve or worsen in the pandemic's aftermath. A crisis can unite citizens, but the pandemic has also sown plenty of divisions in Latin America. Between professionals who can work from home and factory workers who cannot, between vulnerable elderly people and young people who are subject to government restrictions, and between formal workers who receive wage subsidies and the self-employed who have lost all of their income. Latin America's virus contagion curve may be flattening, but some countries' poverty and business bankruptcy curves continue to rise. If the public health shock is followed by a protracted economic crisis that leaves many people behind, trust in government and trust in institutions will suffer, and politics will become even more fractured in Latin America. COVID-19 could yet become a pandemic of instability and hopelessness.
The debate.
The war in Syria is now 10 years old. The devastation and destruction that this country has suffered is beyond words. So what about accountability? The U.S., Saudi Arabia, the U.K., France? Well, the list is rather long, but they were not able to defeat this country and bring it to its knees and to go after their aspirations of enforcing a regime change at a minimum. The 10-year anniversary of the war on Syria, the topic of this edition of The Debate.
It all began in Dara, where people held protests calling for better living conditions. But soon, the rallies were hijacked by armed groups who called on the government to hand over power. The US and its allies began supporting the anti-government forces and fanning the flames of conflict. A year later, clashes spread to every part of the country. In 2013, many Takfiri terrorist groups, including Daesh, were created as a result of the chaos. The terror group named itself a caliphate and took control of large parts of Syria and Iraq and caught the world's attention with its brutality. For the next couple of years, Syrian government forces, backed by Russian air support, focused on defeating Daesh. The Takfiri group has now lost almost all its territory, but is still a major security threat. In the meantime, Damascus had to counter Israel's aerial attacks on its south, deal with a Turkish incursion in the northeastern parts, and tackle US-backed Kurdish forces in the north of the Arab country. That is how a global conflict has been playing out within Syria's borders for the past decade. So far, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and millions displaced. Despite massive financial support for the anti-government forces, Western and some Arab countries failed to topple the Syrian government. Over the past decade, Damascus and foreign-backed militants have held several rounds of talks in a bid to put an end to the conflict. But none of the meetings led to peace in the battle-torn country. A different platform for talks in Kazakhstan, known as the Astana Talks, however, was more productive. In 2017, Russia, Turkey, and Iran signed a deal on the formation of four zones meant to de-escalate the hectic situation in Syria. But the prospect of imminent peace in the Arab nation is still slim, given the continued support for terror groups by some Western and regional states. One thing is clear. The only solution to the crisis in Syria should come from within, where the Syrian people have the right to decide the fate and the future of their country.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, independent researcher and journalist Janice Kortkamp joins us from Leesburg, Virginia. We also have activist and political commentator Leith Maruf, who joins us from Beirut. I'd like to welcome you both. And Janice Kortkamp, let me first start with you. To think that this war in Syria is 10 years old and that it has not ended is quite remarkable and sad at the same time. How would you describe this war on its 10-year anniversary?
Well, it has been devastating for the Syrian people and for the region as well, catastrophic, truly. And, you know, it's lasted this long because the intention is for it to last a long time. Clearly, Syria has emerged as the victor in this attempted regime change war against it, and yet various parties are intent on keeping the conflict going as long as possible. And so we have this horrific wearing down of the Syrian people, not just militarily, like through the U.S. illegal occupation and the SDF mercenary forces, the illegal Turkish occupation, various and sundry terrorist groups that they're still battling around the country, but economically, with the sanctions and the economic siege, really, that's been put around the country, this is prohibiting them from rebuilding their economy and their infrastructure. You know, it's been a war on many fronts, and, there's no end in sight.
Leith Maruf, more than 500,000 people have been killed, according to some records, with millions more who have forced to flee their homes. These numbers could actually be much higher, maybe twice as much. On the other hand, the amount of ammunition poured, or maybe I should say dropped, into this country is also quite remarkable. Which countries are responsible for this war? I mean, how many countries have been involved in this war?
Almost 70 countries were attacking Syria at one point, and that means, you know, all of NATO, many of the Gulf countries, and those who sent their militias there, their Wahhabi contrast, that's even more different, more than 70 countries if you count the origins of these Wahhabi contrasts that invaded the country from Turkey, from Lebanon, and from Jordan at some point, and Iraq. Unfortunately, the objective of the war from the beginning was to destroy the country. Even if they would have won, those who attacked Syria, they wanted the destruction of all of the country, the destruction of its archaeological heritage, and the ethnic cleansing of the country and changing its demographic to suit their needs of what the empire wanted at that point. So, and to basically change history with erasure of not only the people, but also their history and their archaeological record that shows the origin of humanity, language, and culture and religion, to rewrite it in the image of the imperial needs. So right now, the country is reeling from not only the economic siege, as my colleague just said, but also from the looting of its resources. So the oil, this is a country that has self-sufficiency prior to this war in all agricultural and small industry needs and fuel and such forth. A country that had almost zero international debt, now in ruins.
Janice Kortkamp, when we take a look at the number of countries that have been involved in this war, maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit more for us. One thing that is reminiscent in terms of what has been said on this is what Iran's the advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati, has stated, that this was really a mini world war. So your thoughts on that, and why it was that all these countries involved and all this ammunition and weapons, they were not able to defeat the Syrian army?
Well, Syria is an extraordinary country, and this is something that has been missing from the entirety of mainstream media reporting on the topic. The people there are strong. They're firmly rooted to the land. There was a harmony of the society that was extraordinary. And, you know, the Syrian people are amazingly resilient and strong, and they're aware, you know, the vast majority are aware of why their country has been under attack. And they have stood against this attack, and it has cost them dearly. Every family has suffered. Every person has mourned someone dear to them. Many of them can't even afford to buy bread, even tea, anymore. So the as we said before, the effects have been devastating, but the quality of the Syrian culture that has been under attack by every empire, has been coveted, invaded, attacked, often occupied. You know, they've been through this since the dawn of civilization, and it's just been indescribable to watch the strength of these people as they have gone through these 10 years of a horrific nightmare, and still they are surviving. If people in the West had been given any kind of truthful reporting throughout this conflict, they would all be cheering for the Syrian people and Syria as a country, as those of us who have been really tracking it and listening to people in Syria talking about their country, you know, as we all have been.
Well, let's talk about one of the countries involved in this war, and that's Saudi Arabia. Leif Maruf, Saudi Arabia's involvement has been rather large. First of all, the supply of weapons and ammunition to various terrorist groups within Syria. Where was Saudi Arabia getting all its weapons from, and how many terrorist groups was it supporting? And if you can tell us in what form or fashion was Saudi Arabia, along with maybe its allies, if you can tell us how they were operating within Syria by supporting these terrorist groups.
Yes. So obviously Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey were the main operators and of the Contras in Syria. And they, after the destruction of Libya, basically looted the stockpiles of the Libyan government that was just conquered by NATO, and looted in terms of they bought all the stockpile of Ukraine that fell to, again, NATO control after the Ukrainian colored revolution. And most of Eastern Europe, they bought all the old Soviet machinery, and to the point that there is nothing left of the old Soviet weapons that were all in Eastern Europe, and then some. They actually, you know, started buying weapons from all these Eastern European countries that are now part of NATO. You know, that these factories were working at 24 hours to produce the weaponry, and obviously the more sophisticated weapons, the guided missiles, the anti-tank missiles, and so forth, those were directly coming from France and the United States and the UK. And in terms of Saudi regime, we have to remember that the biggest component of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, not only in Syria but all around the world, are citizens from Saudi-occupied Arabia, from the Wahhabi cult. They are the backbone of all of this, and we saw the number of preachers of Wahhabi, you know, death cults, who were on air 24 hours during the majority of the war on Syria. That from the ground, the preaching for the death of minorities and so forth. So, you know, ultimately, all of this has been defeated. We're in this pause situation where the United States and its allies are just prolonging the eventual but hoping at the same time that Syria can't withstand this war of attrition right now that we're living, where, you know, constant Israeli attacks every couple of weeks, and our attacks from Turkey and the United States and its Kurdish militias. You know, so this is where we're at, and hopefully looking at the regional configuration of what's happening in Iraq and what's happening in Yemen, that this is going to come to an end very soon.
Well, you have, Janice Korthkamp, a decade of fighting that has broken up the country practically in terms of the devastation that is caused. But let's talk about a little bit the country's democratically elected President Bashar al-Assad. I mean, through all this, he has remained in power. And, of course, we need to mention the military support that it got from Russia and how Iran also helped in its advisory role. But do you think that this war at some point, if not even to this day, became an obsession with regime change, an obsession with removing Bashar al-Assad from power?
Well, you know, I think the focus has been on President Assad, but really the war, of course, is not about him. The war on either side is about the fact that President Assad was holding true to the primary Syrian goals of resisting Israel and Israel's expansion both in Palestine and in neighboring countries, particularly in Lebanon and in Syria's Golan that they stole, you know, decades ago. So the war was planned from the 1990s by the neocons who came into power under George W. Bush. They've made no secret about this. They were actively working on undermining the Syrian government from the mid-2000s. The sanctions started in 2004. Christiane Amanpour from CNN went to Damascus in 2005 and told President Assad to his face that the U.S. was already picking out a new leader for Syria. This has to do with the U.S. and its allies, you know, intending to remake the Middle East in favor of the Zionist greed and expansionism, as well as U.S. plans for control over the entire region and all of its natural resources. And yet, you know, all the focus has been put on President Assad as a leader. Many people in the West don't even know that Syrian people have complete open access to the internet, for example. They think that they are in some kind of bubble and unaware of the so-called, you know, facts that have been spewed, these false narratives that have been spewed by Western governments and media over the course of these, not just 10 years, but really like 15 years. They are fully aware. And, you know, many of them speak more than one language. They speak English or French. They know exactly what BBC has been pushing down everyone's throats, and CNN and the White House and all of these other outlets. And yet still, as you said, President Bashar is still in power, not just in power, but still able to drive around the country by himself in his own car and his wife as well. And that's indicative of how different reality on the ground in Syria is from virtually every news article and story that's been published or video shown about the conflict to Western audiences.
Yeah, I was very not sure, Leithmer, whether I should ask this question or not on this particular topic, but since our guests there talked about Bashar al-Assad and his wife, I'm gonna ask this. You know, you have this 10-year anniversary taking place with all the different issues involved in this war, and yet you have the UK police who are probing Asma Assad, the wife of the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, for war crimes, and they're saying that they may strip her of her citizenship. I mean, how can they even come out making a statement or query into that when you have, for example, the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair not be investigated and put behind bars for his role in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Of course. I mean, it's the epitome of hypocrisy and white supremacy, if you want to call it as such. And, Tony Blair was responsible, as you rightly pointed, for the war crime, the highest form of war crime, a war of aggression, unauthorized by the Security Council, that led to 1.5 million people dead, and plus the killing of the scientists, the British scientists, that pointed out that there is no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Dr. Kelly. So we, you know, it is the epitome of hypocrisy. Syria and the Syrian people have chosen to stand by the president that they have. They have elected them multiple times. And this is not because there is no, you know, problems in Syria, like, or there wasn't any problems in Syria prior to this global war on the country. Syria is like every other country, has issues to deal with and economies to tinker. But because it's clear that the option presented to the Syrian people, and not only the Syrian people, all the Arab people, the Iranian people, anybody that stands in the way of full domination by America, the choices that we are given is either to resist, stand by our principles, or bow down and become slaves, and allow even the Americans to define what is a Muslim, to define what's an Arab, to define what is our history, and the future of the world. And that's why actually the president of Syria represents his people. That's why the government of Syria and its military withstood the global war on Syria, because of those principles. And it's clear that until now, the will of the Syrian people, just like the will of the Yemeni people and the Palestinian people and many others in the world that are standing up, is not broken. The empire has a choice of more war and more death and more defeat to it, or to realize that it's time to pack up and go back home.
Okay, in less than a minute, if you can, Janice Kortkamp, the current U.S. President Joe Biden promised to end the four-hour wars, but then he went and bombed Syria. And the bombing took place as he pushed for an extension of his war powers. But aside from that, how can he claim diplomacy with the fact that he actually bombed Syria, not to mention the fact that you have Israel that has bombed Syria over 50 times in the past year?
Well, of course, President Biden only promised that nothing much would change, and nobody expected anything different given the war cabinet that he's put in place with his appointees. Many of them are Obama leftovers and people that have made a career of destroying these countries and trying to destroy these countries in the Middle East. And, you know, this is the problem that we have, is that America is a gigantic war machine. We are a global empire, and it's not run by one person. It's run by behind-the-scenes people that wield the power and have the wealth, and they're the ones calling the shots. This is why it doesn't change.
Thank you very much for that. Independent researcher and journalist Janice Kortkamp. And thank you, activist and political commentator Laith Maruf. That does it for this edition of the